All right, in our second lecture, we come to Roman numeral 2 with regard to the Roman persecutions, and that is to speak of the results of them. There was wide apostasy as a result of the persecutions. Rarely, but sometimes, whole congregations apostatized with their bishops at their head. But multitudes of individuals also apostatized. There were three classes of apostates. Sacrificatae, those who sacrifice, libelaticae, those who bribed officials for certificates, and C, traditores, those who handed over the scriptures. So all of these were counted as apostates by the church. If you gave them copies of the Bible to burn, you were apostate. If you bribed an official for a certificate, you were apostate. And if you sacrificed, you were an apostate. Now, a lot of very serious controversies arose over these apostates, because the question was, after the persecution was over and these people wanted to return to the church, could they be forgiven? And if so, how many times could they be forgiven for doing this? These are the kind of questions that people began to ask. At any rate, there was also schism, as I was just saying, over the restoration of apostates. Three different schisms of a serious nature took place related to this issue. After the Decian persecution, circa 260, there were the Miletian schisms in Egypt and the Novatian schism in Rome. After the Diocletian persecution, circa 310, there was the Donatist schism in North Africa that was still going on a century later under Augustine's ministry there as well. Hippolytus led an earlier schism in Rome in 235, but this was healed. Hardliners would not restore apostates. Well, you know, we can look at that and say those legalists, but, you know, man, if your grandpa and grandma and brother and sister had all been killed and these jerks had apostatized, you might not want to let them back into the church either, right? You might question their repentance as well, huh? Well, anyway, they thought that the most the church could do was entreat mercy for them at the last judgment. The moderates favored the idea that apostates could be pardoned if proper repentance was present. Ultimately, the moderates carried the day, and that's good, because they were the people who understood a little something about grace anyway. The Donatism in North Africa shows, by the way, just how hard this could be pressed. The Donatism took place because the Catholic bishop, Catholic as opposed to Donatist, this is the way it took place. The bishop of the Catholic Church there in Carthage, I suppose it was, or someplace in a big town in North Africa, was ordained by a man that was rumored to have been, and not he wasn't the only one that ordained him, laid hands on, but was rumored to have been an apostate, or at least at some level had committed one of these sins, handed over scriptures, or bribed an official for a certificate. And the man who ordained the Catholic bishop was rumored to have been an apostate. Because of this, a Donatus, the author of the Donatist schism, refused to recognize this man as the bishop, and there was a terrible schism in North Africa over it, okay, that lasted for centuries. There are a lot of things that can be said in favor of the Donatists, but really, you know, the fact that the man who ordained the bishop might have had a problem, but that's the way things were. Some perspectives on the Roman persecutions. Many varied estimations have been given of the extent and seriousness of the early persecutions of the church. I'm not capable, maybe no one is, of speaking a final word about this. It does seem clear that a balance must be maintained between two extremes. So by way of setting the Roman persecutions in a proper biblical and realistic perspective, I want to make two points. A, we must not so underrate the ferocity and severity of the Roman persecutions as to deny the fact that, quote, The martyrdom of the first three centuries still remains one of the grandest phenomena of history and an evidence of the indestructible divine nature of Christianity. It was witness these noble martyrs gave and the courage they exhibited that was the reason the church survived and even prospered under persecution. Then, if ever, Satan had his opportunity to stamp out Christianity. It is to the martyrs in great measure that we owe its continuing existence. The words of Tertullian are certainly true in one sense. Go on, rack, torture, grind us to powder. Our numbers increase in proportion as you mow us down. The blood of Christians is their harvest seed. So God overruled the persecution for a witness to the gospel. But B, we must not so overrate the Roman persecutions, as has sometimes been done, that we don't perceive the restraining hand of God upon the Roman beast. The only two persecutions which approach anything like a universal inquisition lasted a total of 15 years, the Decian 6 years and the Diocletian 9 years. For most of the pre-Constantinian period, the persecution of Christians was sporadic, local, and thus ineffective in stopping its spread. Now I'm going to wax theological. How are we to explain this? I believe we are to explain this from the fact that Satan was bound. Satan, the god of this world, the one in which the world lies, has the greatest empire history has ever known, with the most effective form of government ever devised, and he has it at his disposal to destroy the church. On the other hand, you have the defenseless church with the protection of no worldly force able to stand against the legions of Rome. Why does he not stamp it out? I think the answer is in the New Testament in Revelation 21-3, is because Satan is bound. There's no magical sense in which the blood of martyrs is the seed of the church. If Satan could once gather his forces in a unified effort, he might destroy the church, but God has bound him. One day God will unleash him, and when he is on the verge of accomplishing that very purpose, God will intervene. Revelation 20, verses 7-9. I'm trying to remember the name of a book I read, but it was a very interesting book. It had to do with eschatology in the early church. This man was arguing for an amillennial interpretation of Revelation 20 in the early church. You know where he found the most evidence? I can't remember the name of the man or the book. I read the whole thing just about a year ago. Regnum Coelestium, the heavenly kingdom. The place where you find amillennial interpretations of Revelation 20 is in the description of the martyrs and how they went to a blessed reward in heaven and went there to live and reign with Christ. And it's in the description, and he cites many of them, of the martyrs and the blessedness of the martyrs' existence after death, that he finds considerable evidence for an amillennial interpretation of Revelation 20, 4-6 in the New Testament. And that's why the book is named Heavenly Kingdom, because the martyrs were thought to be reigning with Christ in heaven as a result of their sufferings. Well, anyway, again, we have to proceed, even though we have to come to section 4 of our studies. This is the post-Constantinian expansion of the church. Any discussion of the post-Constantinian expansion of the church must give prominence to one figure, and so our outline for section 4 will be an overview of Constantine's life, an evaluation of the Constantinian change, the consequent expansion of the church, and of the expansion of the church outside the empire. Those are Roman numerals 1-4. Now, any discussion of Constantine is made difficult by the difference of opinion which has existed over both him and the historical transition which he epitomizes and represents. There are contrasting opinions of Constantine, very contrasting opinions. One is provided by Verdine. He remarks, well, he provides both of them, actually. Those who held that the coming of Christian sacralism was a boon were likely to paint it in glowing colors. Eusebius wrote, the first church historian, wrote hundreds of pages in praise of the man and the movement. This is Eusebius of Caesarea. And he's writing around the year 330, shortly after Constantine became emperor. Abraham Kuyper, a leading Reformed theologian of our time, seems to have been almost as enthusiastic as was Eusebius. On the other hand, many Protestants of our time, especially those who live in the New World, would have a decidedly less lofty appraisal of Constantine and his innovation, although they might not speak of him as, quote, the murderous egoist who possessed the great merit of having conceived of Christianity as a world power and have acted accordingly, end quote. They will find it increasingly hard to disagree with the late Karl Barth's assessment. That's Karl Barth that said that, called him a murderous egoist. Okay? Well, you can see how very differently then different people have looked. Verdun is writing here in The Anatomy of a Hybrid. If you haven't read Stepchildren of the Reformers and The Anatomy of a Hybrid, you should do that. They're worth the read. Even though he has his own emphatic perspective about Constantine and other things, still very helpful. So Roman numeral 1, an overview of Constantine's life. Born in 272, he reigned from 306 to 337, somewhat as long as any Roman emperor ever stayed on the throne. Maybe Augustus Caesar. Did Augustus Caesar reign for 40 years? I think so, but that's about as long as anybody else. His appearance and character are described by Schaff. He had an imposing and winning person, was compared by flatterers with Apollo. He was tall, broad-shouldered, handsome, and of a remarkably vigorous and healthy constitution, but given to excessive vanity in his dress and outward demeanor, always wearing an oriental diadem, a helmet studded with jewels, and a purple mantle of silk, richly embroidered with pearls and flowers worked in gold. His mind was not highly cultivated, but naturally clear, strong, and shrewd, and seldom thrown off his guard. He is said to have combined a cynical contempt of mankind with an inordinate love of praise. He possessed a good knowledge of human nature and administrative energy and tact. His moral character was not without noble traits, among which a chastity, rare for the time, and a liberality and beneficence bordering on wastefulness were prominent. Many of his laws and regulations breathed the spirit of Christian justice and humanity, promoted the elevation of the female sex, improved the condition of slaves and of unfortunates, and gave free play to the efficiency of the church throughout the whole empire. Altogether, he was one of the best, the most fortunate, and the most influential of the Roman emperors. Christian and pagan, yet, says Schaff, he had great faults. So let's look at his conquests, first of all. The setting of Constantine's conquest was the Diocletian division of the empire. Remember, east and west, and Augustus and Caesar in both, head man, right-hand man. So in the west, this was Maximilian, and his right-hand man was Constantius Chlorus, and then in the east, it was Diocletian and his right-hand man, Galerius. And so, yeah, really, the empire divided into four quarters. It had gotten so big that, in Diocletian's view, no one man could rule it. You had to have some subdivision of authority. The chronology of Constantine's conquest may be listed as follows. In 305, the two Augusta resigned, and the two Caesars succeeded them as the Augusti. In 306, Constantine is acclaimed emperor by the army when his father dies in York. So his father had been the Western emperor. When he dies, the army in Britain proclaims him as the new emperor. In 312, Constantine defeats Maxentius, the new Western Caesar, outside of Rome. So he's been on this victorious march down from Britain. And now he defeats Maxentius outside Rome and marches into Rome as the new victorious Western emperor. In 323, Constantine defeats Licinius, the new Eastern emperor, and he is now sole emperor of the entire Roman Empire, 323. His conversion. We have an account of it here, first of all. Constantine was predisposed to Christianity by several factors. His father respected Christians. His mother was a Christian. His religion was similar to Christianity externally. He held to Mithraism, a kind of solar monotheism, which was a religion common among soldiers. There were many superficial similarities between Christianity and Mithraism. And Chadwick actually brings this out. The transition from solar monotheism to Christianity was not difficult. In Old Testament prophecy, Christ was entitled the Son of Righteousness. Clement of Alexandria, circa AD 200, speaks of Christ driving his chariot across the sky like the sun god. A tomb mosaic recently found at Rome, probably made early in the 4th century, depicts Christ as the sun god mounting the heavens with his chariot. Tertullian says that many pagans imagine the Christians worshiped the sun because they met on Sundays and prayed towards the east. Moreover, early in the 4th century, there begins in the West, where first and by whom is not known, the celebration of 25 December, which is not first the birthday of Christ, but the birthday of the sun, the solstice, winter solstice. Okay? I know, we know it's December 21, but it was December 25 then. How easy it was for Christianity and solar religion to become entangled at the popular level is strikingly illustrated by a mid-5th century sermon of Pope Leo the Great, rebuking his overcautious flock for paying reverence to the sun on the steps of St. Peter's before turning their back on it to worship inside the westward-facing basilica. Good night. Well, you either laugh or cry, don't you? Thus, on Constantine's coins, Sol Invictus was engraven on one side, the unconquered sun, and the cross on the other side. Constantine's so-called conversion occurred in 311 and 312. In 311, he saw a vision of the cross against the sun while fighting barbarians. You see that vision in the sky there, has the left-hand diagram. In 312, before his battle against Maxentius, he sought the God of the Christians' help, and that night he had a dream directing him to mark his shields and labrum with the monogram of Christ, as they say, the rest of history. In the middle, you see the Cairo monogram. You know, Cairo, the first letters of Christ, Christos, and popular monogram then was Chi Rho, Christos, okay? And then the labarum is illustrated on the far right there, and you can see the similarity it bears then to a cross. What shall we think of Constantine's conversion? Bruce remarks, there is no reason to doubt the genuineness of Constantine's acceptance of Christianity. Well, there is a certain modicum of truth in this rather unqualified statement. Constantine seemed to sincerely desire to be known as a Christian and to promote Christianity. This desire and commitment becomes more marked as his life progresses. I think Needham, in his church history, gives a fairly positive account of Constantine's desires at some level to defend him from a lot of the nasty stuff that's been said about him. And, well, a lot of the nasty stuff is true. The question is, how do you judge it? How do you evaluate it? How do you weight it? This desire and commitment becomes more marked as his life progresses. Furthermore, he sincerely believed in the power of the Christian's God and at least his ability to aid him in battle. On the other hand, if proof means for us to believe that Constantine was a true Christian, well, that's doubtful. There may be little argument, as Bruce says, that he compares well with Henry VIII, but then that's not saying very much. His faith may have been severe, but it was hardly saving. It had everything to do with military defeat and victory and little, or perhaps nothing, to do with sin and grace. Schaff has this comment on his religion. He reasoned, as Eusebius reports from his own mouth, in the following manner. My father revered the Christian God and uniformly prospered, while the emperors who worshipped the heathen gods died a miserable death. Therefore, that I may enjoy a happy life and reign, I will imitate the example of my father, join myself to the cause of the Christians who are growing daily while the heathen are diminishing. Not to be cynical, but what are we have here something similar to the modern football player who does the sign of the cross after scoring a touchdown or points heavenward or something like that. Attributing to God your football success is not the same as having saving faith, is it? Anyway, Schaff further reports on his manner of life. He was far from being so pure and venerable as Eusebius, blinded by his favor to the church, depicts him in his bombastic and almost dishonestly eulogistic biography with the evident intention of setting him up as a model for all future Christian princes. It must with all regret be conceded that his progress in the knowledge of Christianity was not a progress in the practice of its virtues. His love of display and his prodigality, his suspiciousness and his despotism increased with his power. The very brightest period of his reign is stained with gross crimes, which even the spirit of the age and the policy of an absolute monarch cannot excuse. After having reached upon the bloody path of war, the goal of his ambition, the sole possession of the empire, moreover, in the very year in which he summoned the great council of Nicaea, he ordered the execution of his conquered rival and brother-in-law, Licinius, in breach of a solemn promise of mercy. Not satisfied with this, he caused soon afterwards, from political suspicion, the death of the young Licinius, his nephew, a boy of hardly 11 years. But the worst of all is the murder of his eldest son, Crispus, in 326, who had incurred suspicion of political conspiracy and of adulterous and incestuous purposes toward his stepmother, Fausta, but is generally regarded as innocent. At all events, Christianity did not produce in Constantine a thorough moral transformation. He was concerned more to advance the outward social position of the Christian religion than to further its inward mission. Well, you can make up your own mind about that, but I think Schaff is probably correct. Whatever spiritual change may have accompanied Constantine's baptism late in life, and this was at the hands, by the way, of an Arian bishop, the events of 311 and 312 bear little resemblance to true conversion. Chadwick properly remarks, if his conversion should not be interpreted as an inward experience of grace, neither was it a single cynical act of Machiavellian cunning. It was a military matter. He was sure that victory in battle lay in the gift of the God of the Christians. Well, let's see. That brings us to Roman numeral 2, an evaluation of the Constantinian change. And I think we'll stop right here. That's a fairly short lecture, but we'll finish up. We have just about the right amount of material to finish up after this. So let's stop right there. Questions, comments, ridicule, scorn? any questions? Yes, Andrew.
Now, I was kind of interested in the fact that those who handed over the scriptures would be considered apostate.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, obviously, the value that the scriptures were, I mean, is hard to even conceive of. Given the rarity of it, but still to consider them apostate, I find interesting.
Yeah. Well, I can only speculate, but the possibility is that in order to get the authorities off their back, they had to give the authorities something to come away with and to show their superiors that they'd been good persecutors of the Christians. And so giving them Bibles to burn was a way of mollifying the authorities, I think. And that was viewed with, well, great severity, yeah. I mean, objectively, I can understand your point. You may be right. Historically, putting yourself in the situation, I think if you think about it long enough, you might feel some sympathy for how other Christians might feel. This was just a dodge to get out of persecution. I think that's the way it was looked at. But I guess the one other thing I would add is, of course, it's true that you can see from some of the things we said that there are some really hardline attitudes. I mean, the idea that someone who had sacrificed could not repent or ever be forgiven is certainly extreme, even if we take very seriously the sinfulness of apostasy. And that's what it was. But this kind of apostasy, I don't think qualifies for the unpardonable sin taught in the New Testament. So I mean, I think some of it you have to see as a little bit of an indication of a hardlinism, which I think shows a loss of something of the understanding of the gospel into legalism. And that's certainly going on in the early church. It's hard to know how seriously to evaluate it, but it's certainly happening over the centuries. Other questions? Yeah.
I think you meant Regnum Caelorum.
Thank you. That's right. Do you remember the author of it? Did I assign parts of that in eschatology or something?
Yeah.
Regnum Caelorum. Charles Hill. Teaches at RTS Orlando, at least the last I knew he did. It's a great book on early church eschatology. I profited greatly from it. Understand, it's also a very technical, scholarly book, but Regnum Caelorum, not Caelestium. Caelorum, though, means heavenly, although you might have accepted Caelestium or something, but not that I'm any expert on Latin. But yeah.
Why did the Christians pray toward the east? I mean, I assume that is, I have a guess, but could you speak on that?
That's a good question. My guess would be that it has something to do still with Jerusalem, with the earthly city of Jerusalem. Does it say they prayed toward the east? Someplace, where did it say that? Yeah.
It says that Tertullian says.
Oh.
Then he goes on.
Let me see the quotation. That might help me out. Tertullian says that many pagans imagine the Christians worshiped the suns because they met on Sundays and prayed towards the east. I know there are references to Christians praying toward the east. It might have had to do something to do with Jerusalem. I think that's it, but I'm not sure. And of course, the fact that they did is superstition, in my opinion. Okay. We'll take about a 9-minute break and start at about 5 after.